My only trip ever to Paris was a 3-day whirlwind many years ago. I knew I didn't have time for the Louvre, so I went instead to the Rodin Museum and fell in love. The white roses climbing a stone wall, the stillness inside despite the crowd, the sunlight streaming through floor-to-ceiling arched windows, lighting the sculpture's stark beauty. This was before I knew how Rodin treated his lover, Camille Claudel, and how much credit she deserved for his work, and how she wound up institutionalized, one more woman rendered officially insane by annoyed or nervous relatives. I have kept that knowledge carefully apart, so the museum can still shine in my memory. It was once a hotel, you know. Rodin lived there, sprawled across 4 ground floor rooms, his gramophone filling the air with Gregorian chants. The other tenants included a free-spirited dancer named Isadora Duncan, 19-year-old Jean Cocteau, the painter Henri Matisse, and Rainer Maria Rilke, who worked for a time as Rodin's secretary. Eager for more information, surely there were collaborations, squabbles, affairs, I stumble upon The Tenants of the Hotel Biron, a playful novel by Lara Morello. She invites others to rent apartments in the hotel. Photographer Edouard Steichen, the Russian ballet dancer Vaslav Nijinsky, a young Spanish painter called Pablo Picasso, an older painter he admired called Henri Rousseau, and composer Erik Satie. I feel like I'm at a reunion, surrounded by people I have loved and enjoyed for years and eager to hear the gossip. Morello begins with Camille Claudel's letters not sent, letting Steichen introduce their existence. He tells us that in 1943, he received an unsigned note. "I am dying now. I love you. I will see you again." He thought it was for him and could not imagine who had sent it. But 2 weeks later, Claudel's twin sons, many scholars believe she did bear Rodin 2 boys, came to see Steichen. They had Rodin's soft eyes under his stern brows, but Camille's beautiful nose and mouth. They handed over a box of letters their mother had written to Rodin but never sent. Her dying wish was that Steichen have them, her contribution to a book he was editing about the Hotel Biron. That book is the novel's fictional premise, and the artists in residence offer pieces of plot. The setting has its own backstory. Built in the 18th century for a duke, the Hotel Biron was one of the most elegant mansions in the Faubourg Saint-Germain before it was converted to the Couvent du Sacré-Cœur, a convent and Catholic girls' school. It fell into disrepair. Catholic girls can be hard on a place, all that energetic stomping and secret smoking. And then it was turned into a hotel. Matisse taught art classes in the former chapel. This we know to be true. Morello places the rebellious 19-year-old Jean Cocteau in the sacristy, which he decorates with hanging goatskins. But the novel's centerpiece is Camille Claudel. We watch her fall in love with Rodin, and to my delight, she's spirited from the start. "I know you have these ideas because you're jealous," she tells Rodin, "because my work was exhibited and reviewed in the newspapers by the time I was 15, and you are only now getting exhibited and reviewed at the age of 40. I hope she was that crisp, and this is not score evening revision on the part of Morello. After all, she researched these lives for 15 years before spinning her tale. Rather than blame Rodin for taking advantage of her, Claudel writes, "No, I'm not sorry we made love. If I were going to be sorry, I wouldn't have done it. You needn't fear for my chastity. No artist has a chaste heart. That is what my family fears." Especially Paul, the ultra-Catholic brother who would eventually sign her away to a mental institution, as Rodin stood by and did nothing. Rodin could have driven anyone mad, but Claudel's love is clear-eyed, aware of his manipulations. "It is truly cunning," she writes, "the way you manage to have your place at the dinner table changed to suit whatever angle you need to gaze upon the great writer that day, and the way you can draw so skillfully on those tiny cigarette papers without Victor Hugo noticing." Later, when he is returning to Rose, "Who would be happier without you?" Claudel writes, "I finally see that it is not so much that you want me, or you want Rose, or you want any particular relationship or woman. You simply want to have your own way at all costs. And so whatever anyone else wants, you oppose." When she is locked up, she blames Rodin as well as her family. "But above all," she writes, "I blame myself for my lack of cunning and deceit. I should have pretended to you that I had no grand aspirations, and to my family that I was chaste. It is my great failure in life that I could not fool you or them. I was not capable of deceit." Her voice, and the others in this novel, ring so true that I find myself believing every word. Indeed, many of the details are true. Picasso did devour Sherlock Holmes and Buffalo Bill's novels. Rodin did feel guilty enough to, temporarily, give up art when his sister fell ill and died. "A broken heart," their mother diagnosed, and how could he not have known that his little sister had fallen in love with his friend? Steichen also tells us, quite plausibly, that Cocteau, in his impatience to be famous and loved by great men, insists he wants to meet Rilke but is afraid of coming inside the main house. Rilke, for his part, wanders around the house in a trance and doesn't speak to anyone. Rousseau was convinced that there were ghosts in the house. "At night," Steichen writes, "I can hear him chasing them and swatting at them with magazines and paint rags." That I can't confirm. But he could well have begged all the tenants of the house to write letters to his new girlfriend about what a wonderful man and painter he was. He would die a year later, suffering from an infected leg wound and from her rejection. Picasso's contribution to Steichen's book is an essay about the ancient tribe of post-impressionists, a group of nomads who only lived in direct sunlight. After their tribe traipsed Cézanne, who was less interested in the way light hit and instead painted the forms that he saw in the objects. He couldn't use models because he was embarrassed to hire them, Picasso divulges. As a result, his nudes are oddly shaped. "Of the emotions, Gauguin liked unsatisfied desire the best," Picasso continues. "Van Gogh was cranky and fought with everyone in Paris. Toulouse-Lautrec painted with oil on cardboard. He didn't steam his pencils into syrup the way Degas did. Matisse said you have to seek the desire of the line." Gertrude Stein said that Cubism was Spanish. She said only the Americans and the Spanish understood abstraction, the Americans through disembodiment, and the Spanish through ritual. Eric Satie's contribution is refreshingly practical and includes priceless advice for recovering from illness. Travel cures disordered imaginations, unbridled passions, jealous characters, worried dispositions, and headaches, but only in thin women, he notes. As for taking the waters, this does not cure anything, but is satisfying if you wish to gamble or find your daughter a husband. Fresh air, exercise, drinking plenty of water, and eating a vegetarian diet? Hogwash. It makes you oversensitive, and you're bound to contract every ailment that's tangoing through Paris. Living on a boat in the Seine and playing music during meals? It makes the fish terribly ill. Near the novel's end, we return to Steichen's calm, attentive diary. "Matisse scratches out certain forms on a canvas, but leaves their traces visible," he says. "Someday this technique will be the rage in New York. I must tell Alfred Stieglitz about it. There's something fussy and irritable about it that would appeal to a New York painter." Picasso continues to be afraid that Nijinsky is losing his mind. He says he has never seen so many examples of human destruction as the result of lost or thwarted love as have passed through the Hotel Biron. Of course, he blames it on women. One of those women has the last word. "I am going to die now," Camille Claudel writes to Rodin. "I will not be joining you in hell, because, as you know, my sins of hubris, martyrdom, bitterness, exaggeration, and the excessive way I cherished my own victimization hurt no one but myself. I have arranged for my sons to steal my body from the asylum after I die and bury it under the window of my room at the Hotel Biron," she continues. "I am not abdicating to you. I do not see the Hotel Biron as a museum for your works, even though since 1919 that is what it has become. I see the Hotel Biron as a house in Paris where, for just a few years, several great artists lived under the same roof and pursued their art. I want to be a part of that now, even though it is too late." Young and dreamy on that visit to Paris, I would have said I wanted to be a part of it too. Now, smiling over ridiculous eccentricities, wincing at the various feuds and tragedies, admiring the genius but not the cruelty it permitted, I'm not so sure.